This is Audible.
Orion Fiction presents The Duke at Hazard by K.J. Charles. Read by Cornell Collins. One can live well, even in a palace. Marcus Aurelius. Meditations. Book 5. Chapter 16. Chapter 1. Vernon Fortescue Cassian George de Vere Cross, the 4th Duke of Severn, the Earl of Harmsford, Baron Cross of Wotton, and Baron Vere, walked into an inn. They were all the same man. He did not announce himself by all of his titles or any of them. Nobody did it for him either. Nobody slipped in front of him to open the doors or bowed to greet him. In fact, nobody paid him any attention at all. A couple of heads turned at his entry, but their gazes slipped over him without interest and away. He was water off a flock of ducks. That might have been rather lowering if he'd believed that the usual stern attention his arrival created was due to his good looks and imposing presence, rather than his slew of titles. However, the Duke was all too aware of his moderate height, nondescript features, quiet ways, and general sad lack of ducal authority. He was nothing without his titles, and he knew it. Nobody would pick him from a crowd. Nobody would look twice at him without the trappings he'd been born to. Well, one man had. The Duke took a deep breath of the smoky air in the inn's parlour, ripely fragranced by spilled beer, insufficiently washed bodies, and the ghost of a pork joint that had spent too long at the fire. It smelled like freedom. He probably ought to have a drink, he thought. He had plenty of money, but he wasn't sure how to apply it. Should he expect to be shown to a table or seat himself and wait to be attended? There were men standing at an elbow-high bar receiving ale. Did one purchase it oneself? Was one meant to join in with the friendly banter they exchanged with the buxom woman at the bar? Or would that be a solecism? If one did join in, what did one say? The Duke of Severn knew to a nicety how to judge a bow to people on every rung of the aristocracy, including his equals, all 25 of them, and superiors, the royal family. He knew how to behave at a rout, a soiree, Almack's or White's. He might be personally negligible, but he had never put a foot wrong socially, in large part because he kept to the limited elevated circles considered appropriate to his station. In the public bar of the Bird in Hand, he was suddenly and terrifyingly uncertain.
"Mr. Wotton?" said a voice at his ear.
It took the Duke a second to remember that was himself. He turned to see the man he'd come to meet.
"Good evening," he said,
and forgot all about public house etiquette in the rush of relief. The Duke had been on an informal visit to a school friend in Gloucester, accompanied only by his valet, two footmen, groom, and an outrider. He'd shed the lot of them to take the air in a park one evening, and there seen a man in a mulberry coat, a dark-haired fellow with a roguish sort of look. Eyes had met. There had been a little casual conversation, the brush of a hand, a tempting smile. Very tempting indeed. And the Duke had duly fallen. Not under his own name or names, of course. He'd called himself George Wotton, enjoyed a brief but very satisfying fumble in the darkness, and agreed to meet a few days later at the Bird in Hand Inn. That had meant ridding himself of his retinue by underhand means that involved letting them believe he was meeting a woman. And the sense of release was exhilarating. Just for tonight, he would be an ordinary man, without the weight of rank, his behavior scrutinized by nobody except his partner. Just for tonight, he would be with a man who was attracted by his person, who didn't need to be paid to be there, who wanted the man, not the Duke. He couldn't wait.
John Martin, his companion, had secured a private parlour to dine, saying it was his treat. The Duke had never had a man spend money on him before. That was his role in the few encounters he'd had, and he didn't resent it. He knew very well he was paying for the company. Now he found himself stunned by the little kindness, which seemed like more than was necessary, more than an assignation. It felt like courting, and it made him warm all over. And John Martin was a witty, amusing man with a lively manner, and the Duke found himself wondering, if things went well, whether he might dare to propose a third meeting. That was dreaming. He was here for a night's illicit pleasure. He really couldn't have more. But all the same, he tingled with anticipation and ate the stringy boiled fowl with more enjoyment than he took in his own French cook's roasted quail. They moved upstairs to a small bedroom. John pulled him over and kissed him. And it was good. Not perfect, because his head was a little clouded by two mugs of strong ale, followed by a glass of gin, which he tossed back with unwise abandon, seeking Dutch courage or perhaps just wanting to be roguish and reckless for once. He was unquestionably rather drunk, and also John had very decided views on what he wanted, which weren't precisely in step with the Duke's own preferences. That didn't matter. If he wanted his desires fulfilled to the letter, there was always that discreet London house where he could have whatever he wanted supplied with a smile. He was here incognito precisely because he didn't want to be pandered to. He wanted to discover what it was like when the goal was mutual pleasure, not his alone. Which meant that when John said uncompromisingly that he wanted to be buggered, the Duke obliged him. It was good enough. John certainly seemed to enjoy it, though the Duke was starting to feel more than a little dizzy by the end. John suggested another drink before the second bout, and the Duke accepted another glass of gin because he'd already had too much to be sensible. And he didn't remember anything more. He woke up with a headache like knives and a nasty taste in his mouth. He blinked his throbbing eyes open and sat up carefully. He was alone in the bed, which was good, discreet, sensible, but also regrettable. How had he fallen asleep so early and foolishly? He hoped John wasn't offended. Maybe he was downstairs. Maybe he'd waited. The Duke cast a glance around the room to see if John had left his things. It was bare of the clothes they'd strewn around, and of the Duke's travelling bag, which he'd carried himself. Had Waters, his valet, come in and tidied up? The Duke had a pulse of alarm at that before remembering that Waters wasn't here. He sat up again, too sharply for his head, and got out of bed, realizing he was naked. His clothes were nowhere to be seen. He turned to the single chest, wondering if John had put them away, and saw a sheet of paper on top of it with a couple of lines of scrawled writing. You really ought to be more careful. Don't put temptation in people's way. I won't trouble you further if you don't trouble me. The Duke stared at that. Then he checked the chest, which was, of course, empty, looked under the bed in one last desperate hope, and sat down on it, hard. He'd been robbed. John Martin had stolen his clothes, his money, his silver hairbrushes, everything. And that second line, was that a threat? If he made a fuss, if Martin was tracked down and the Duke prosecuted him, would the villain make counter-accusations? The Duke imagined himself the subject of a prosecution for sodomy, the newspaper reports, his family's reaction. Surely it could not come to anything, he was the Duke of Severn. But the shame alone was a prospect to make his whole soul cringe. He felt sick to his stomach with bad gin and mortification and crashing disappointment. It wasn't that he'd cared for John Martin, but he'd briefly imagined a world in which he might one day come to care for him. Just as he'd imagined that Martin had seen something appealing in his own nondescript person, picked him from a crowd and liked what he'd seen. Clearly his imagination was overactive. Because he'd also imagined that he could manage one single evening without a regiment of people taking charge of his life. He put his face in his hands as if that could hide him from the humiliation, and felt something wrong in the touch of his skin. Something missing. It took him a second to realize what, and then it hit him with the force of a slap. His ring, the Severn ring, wrought of Welsh gold from the Cross family's mine, a gnarled dragon worn by every duke since the first, taken from his father's still warm corpse and put frighteningly loose on his own 6-year-old finger. He'd worn it every day of his life since, with various artful attachments to keep it safe until his hands had reached their adult growth and it had been sized for him. He'd left behind his retinue and his embroidered linen to come to this assignation, but he hadn't even considered taking off the Severn ring. It proved him the Duke of Severn when nothing else did. And it was gone. The rest of the day was a bad dream. He had to poke his head out of the door with a blanket wrapped around him so as not to outrage any serving maid, and summon the landlord, and beg him to send a message for his valet, on the promise of lavish reward once his money arrived. At this point, he learned that John Martin had left him to pay the shot for last night's meal as well as the cost of the room. He sat on the bed in his blanket for hours, since he had no clothes and the landlord was too suspicious to lend him any, and enlivened the time by alternately kicking himself for his stupid self-delusion and searching frantically for his ring, as if it could have somehow fallen off his finger. At last his valet Waters arrived in a flurry of competence for which the Duke could only feel grateful, bearing clothes and money and terrifying authority borrowed from the Dukes he'd served for 50 years. He restored the Duke to decency, gave the landlord a dressing down that left the man in a state of grovelling apology, and swept the Duke into the comfort of his well-sprung carriage. Waters did not ask what had happened. The Duke told him anyway. A version whereby he had indulged in an evening of manly pleasures of the acceptable kind, drink, gambling, a hint of women, and been robbed. There was no way to avoid that admission. He'd just have to endure the embarrassment and hope the tale stayed within the family. He tried to make a story of it, a comical misadventure, the kind of thing that could happen to a seasoned man of the world, more to practice that version than out of any hope his valet might take it lightly. As indeed he did not.
"Your Grace must not jest," he said, real distress in his voice. "Anything might have happened. You could have been killed. These brutes have no mercy."
The Duke put out a reassuring hand.
"Since I wasn't in the slightest harmed."
Waters wasn't listening. His eyes bulged.
"Your Grace, the ring. They steal the Severn ring?"
The Duke opened his mouth to make the dreadful admission and heard himself say,
"No.
No, but
a very lucky chance,"
said the Duke's voice, which seemed to have overpowered his mind.
"I caught my finger in a door earlier, so I took the ring off. In case it swelled, I have it safe."
Waters pantomimed relief with a hand on his heart.
"Thank heavens. To have lost the Severn ring."
"Yes," the Duke said, strangled. "That would be unthinkable."
"Unforgivable. Your grandfather was so gracious as to inform me it was his most precious possession, valued over all else. He called it the honour of the house."
The Duke knew that. He'd been told over and over that he was the ring's custodian, that it represented everything he ought to be, that it should always be worn and could never be lost. He felt giddy with horror, sick with shame. He wanted to curl up and cry. He'd have to admit the truth at some point. Why had he not just done it now and got it over with? Well, that was easy enough. It was because he'd have no way to explain why he wasn't sending to Bow Street for their best men to track down the thief. Even so,
All he'd achieved by lying was to delay the inevitable. It was pure cowardice, running away from trouble like the child Waters still thought him. His valet would be so disappointed by the truth. His uncle would be furious. The journey back to Staplow, the ducal seat, seemed to take both forever and not nearly long enough. The Duke spent several minutes greeting the staff who lined up to welcome him back after his brief absence, knowing too well that while he chatted, Waters would be rushing to tell Lord Hugo about the whole sorry affair. The two old men had been allies in guarding and protecting the orphaned child Duke for too long to lose the habit in his manhood. His only hope was to present the whole affair as an absurdity, and hope his uncle could be brought to regard it in the same casual manner as he did his own son's mishaps. His uncle did not.
"Are you quite mad, Seven, making light of this?" Lord Hugo demanded. "And you don't propose to summon the Bow Street runners? The Duke of Seven made drunk, robbed, his person outraged."
"My person was not outraged in the least," the Duke interrupted.
That, he was quite sure, was true. His larcenous lover had even tucked a blanket over him to keep the chill off.
"And I can't claim to have been made drunk. That was my own fault."
"I don't know why you young men are so easily disguised. In my day, anything less than a three-bottle man, but that is not to the point. Of course you will summon the runners,
and have the story get about within days. I really should prefer not to make myself a public laughingstock. I have been taught a lesson, and will learn it with all the grace I can muster."
"Damned well hope you do. To go off on your own in such a careless manner, what were you thinking of, boy?"
"I am a grown man," the Duke pointed out. "Leo and Matthew go off on their own, as you put it, all the time."
"Ha! They don't matter,"
Lord Hugo said of his beloved sons.
"You are Seven, and I will not permit this recklessness."
"Ah, permit, uncle?"
The Duke loved his uncle, and owed him a great deal. But his long minority had ended at the age of 25. And he had steeled himself to challenge those many habits of speech when his cousins had informed him that if he didn't, he would spend the rest of his life a schoolboy. It didn't come naturally. Lord Hugo lifted a hand in irritable acknowledgement.
"Yes, yes, I misspoke. But this is an outrage, and you must take it seriously."
"Believe me, I do," the Duke assured him. "Notwithstanding, I have learned a lesson at the cost of £50, a coat that I was not quite pleased with, a pair of hairbrushes, and a bad head. There are worse fates."
"I will say for you, you don't make a fuss. Not but what you ought to be a deal higher in the instep,"
Lord Hugo added in one of his instant contradictions that made him such a trying conversational partner.
"That spirit of uncomplaint is a very admirable thing in any man. But you are not any man. You are Seven."
"So I should rant and rage for my offended dignity?" the Duke asked, with a quizzical look. "Dear sir, why, when you do it so ably on my behalf?"
That got a reluctant laugh from his uncle.
"Insolent dog," he said,
once again forgetting that his nephew outranked him.
"Well, you will decide, I suppose. But no more of this gallivanting around on your own without your proper attendance. You must know your position better."
He returned to the subject at dinner. It was an informal family meal. Just the Duke, his two resident aunts, widowed Amelia and spinster Hilda, their brother, Lord Hugo, and his sons, cousin Matthew, who was 20 and ought to have been at Oxford but for an incident on a race course, and cousin Leo, who was 28 and ought to have been in London but for an incident in a gaming hell. Both aunts had fluttered, worried, and mourned what their poor mother would have said about the boy's wildness. Lord Hugo had accepted both sons' rustication with a deal less dismay than he did any transgression on the Duke's part. Inevitably, Lord Hugo went over the whole sorry business as soon as they sat down to dine. Leo and Matthew found it hilarious, which the Duke attempted to take in good part, aided by the free-flowing wines, of which he partook more than usual, in an effort to numb his still aching head.
In other circumstances, he could perhaps have laughed sincerely. Not at the personal betrayal, which he flinched from considering, but certainly at the spectacle of the Duke of Severn huddled in a blanket and hiding from a suspicious landlord. He wanted to remember it as ludicrous. He would far rather be the butt of a ridiculous affair than the victim of hurt and unkindness and crushed hope. He could have laughed, if it wasn't for the ring. As it was, he thanked the Lord for his family's habitual obliviousness, which meant nobody had noticed his bare finger and spared him repeating the lie, and wondered what the devil he was going to do. He had to get it back, that was all. A discreet, exceedingly discreet, private agent to investigate, perhaps. There would surely be someone who would pursue the matter on his behalf, and who would know how to track down a thief who doubtless wasn't called John Martin at all, and of whom the Duke could say little more than the colour of his hair and coat. He wondered how he might seek out a discreet private agent without word getting back to his uncle.
"You're not attending to me, Severn,"
Lord Hugo remarked, jolting him from his thoughts.
"I suppose rag manners are the fashion these days."
"You have read him the same lesson several times, sir,"
Leo observed to his parent with pardonable exasperation.
"Yes, he was reckless to go abroad without attendance. The point is made."
"Well, and do you dispute it?"
"Of course I don't. The way you have wrapped him in lamb's wool all his life, it is no surprise that any effort to look after himself should end in disaster."
"I've done no such thing," Lord Hugo objected inaccurately. "Naturally, Severn's safety has been my paramount concern."
"Such that he now can't go on a spree without losing his shirt."
"Literally.
Even Matthew can hold his drink better, and the Lord knows he's a featherweight."
"I say,"
Matthew put in, and was ignored by all.
"You're harsh, Leo,"
the Duke said, keeping his voice mild, though he felt decidedly stung.
"I grant you I did not show to advantage last night, and I know I lack worldly experience."
"Lack experience? That is to understate the case. Could you even survive without the constant ministrations of the faithful Waters and your groom and your footmen? Good Lord, Sev, you're held up by a scaffolding of service. No wonder you collapse without it." "I say,"
Matthew repeated, this time in a more worried tone. There was something unusually aggressive in Leo's voice, more than the usual family give and take, and the Duke's bruised feelings found relief in responsive anger. "That is unjust," he said. "I am not a fool or a weakling. I have been robbed once."
"You've been out once."
"At least I have not returned to be robbed again and again at a single spot," the Duke retorted.
"I'm not that easily shorn."
Leo had lost a great deal of money to the same men at the same hell over 3 evenings, a proceeding on which his father had commented in unflattering terms. He reddened.
"Easy to say from your noble heights. You have no more knowledge of the world than a baby, and no more force of character either, and it is no surprise that you cannot manage without a retinue. If you attempted to take the public stage,
I would learn to do it just as you did. Purchasing a seat in a coach can hardly be a conundrum requiring membership of the Royal Society to solve.
And carry your own bags, command rooms and meals.
Make your own way without the glory of the Duke of Severn opening all doors for you.
Admit it, you'd be helpless."
"Of course I could do all that," the Duke snapped. And in that moment his great idea rushed upon him, carried on a wave of wine and anger.
"I could,"
he repeated,
"and since you suggested, I shall.
Do you care to make a wager of it?" Leo sat up straight.
"Wager?"
Aunt Amelia squeaked. Aunt Hilda barked a laugh. Lord Hugo said,
"Eh?"
"I would do very well by myself, and I shall prove it," the Duke insisted. "I shall fend for myself without all the advantages of Severn for, let's say, a month."
"You will do no such thing."
Leo ignored his father. "Without servants and without use of your title or your social connections for assistance or influence, a month without privilege, without using any of it, entirely anonymous."
"But what are you going to do for a month like that?"
Matthew asked.
Travel, the Duke said recklessly. Explore the country. Gain the experience Leo wishes for me.
You'll find it dashed uncomfortable. Dashed dull, too. You must have rats in your attic, Sev. If I were a Duke, I shouldn't set foot on the stage for the rest of my life. Who cares if you don't do things for yourself? Why would you bother when you're 7? Dash it, what if you're pretending to be nobody and you meet someone you know?
I'll just have to avoid fashionable haunts. Nobody will recognize you without your pomp and circumstance, Leo said, all the more brutally because it was a statement of fact.
You have a damned forgettable face. If you weren't dressed up, you wouldn't look like anyone at all. I have often observed my brother didn't consider the breeding stock when he married, Aunt Hilda said. Joan was a delightful woman, but sadly unremarkable. Typical of a Malstrom, all their girls were plain as Hilda, really,
Aunt Amelia said.
This is not to the purpose.
Lord Hugo glowered at his sisters to no effect, then turned on the younger generation.
And you will both stop this nonsense.
It is a wager, the Duke said. I shall fend for myself for a month without using my title or influence or advantages. And when I have done so, you, Leo, will make an apology to me for doubting my capacity.
If you do it, Leo returned.
Using the public stage and inns as any common fellow might, no hiring a carriage or any such. If you survive a month of ordinary life without disaster and without resorting to your title or station, I shall admit I was wrong as publicly as you like. And the stakes if you don't succeed. He paused, thinking. The Duke braced himself. Your match grays.
What? No.
You can't wager money, Leo pointed out. It doesn't mean anything to you, and Father would have an apoplexy.
Yes, I would.
Lord Hugo had never permitted betting or borrowing. The ducal estate was the Duke's alone, and he had rigidly avoided any action that might be interpreted as profiting from his nephew.
You know very well.
Yes, sir, we do, his son said impatiently.
Stake the greys, Sev, if you're so sure it's easy.
The Duke adored his greys. He had bought them as foals, trained them himself, and driven them for 2 years now, turning down extravagant offers. They were his sole point of personal glory. People who would not recognize him in a crowd knew the Duke of Severn's greys. Fast, sweet steppers, perfectly matched, high-spirited but never misbehaving. He didn't want to lose them.
Or if you don't care to risk it, Leo added.
The Duke set his teeth. He needed this time, this free month in which he would go out into the world and get his ring back by hook or crook. Not to mention he was cursed if he'd back down now. He would just have to make sure he won his bet.
Very well, he said. The Greys.
Chapter 2. Waters came in the next morning, bearing a tea tray in his hands and the world on his shoulders.
Your Grace, he said, I am informed of the most distressing news. It cannot be correct.
My wager with Leo.
The Duke had been awake for some time, wondering if his great idea was in fact quite as great as it had seemed last night under the influence of several glasses of wine and the flush of insult. The concept was impeccable. A month in which he could track down the scoundrel John Martin and retrieve his ring. It was the execution, specifically the fact that he had no idea how to go about executing it, that worried him.
But your Grace cannot seriously intend this.
Waters looked distraught.
To travel alone without your carriage or James or a single outrider or a wardrobe? Without me?
It is only for a month, the Duke said soothingly.
A month? Your Grace jests. Who will brush your coats and see to your linen? What about your boots?
I expect inns have people who do that,
Hardly to the standards your grace expects.
Indeed not. It will teach me to appreciate you.
Your grace,
Waters said strongly.
You must not. Surely Lord Hugo objects.
I dare say he does, but I don't require his permission.
Or yours, the Duke did not say. Because exasperating though it was to be nannied, Waters had cared for him all his life. The tightening of the valet's lips suggested he had taken the inference anyway, and was offended. The Duke sighed internally.
Will you help me select the most ordinary clothes from my wardrobe?
Waters stiffened even more.
Your grace does not possess any ordinary clothes.
This was true. The Duke's coats were made by Hawkes or Weston, and it showed even if he did not display them to any great advantage. In the end, he resorted to borrowing a couple of Matthew's older coats, noting with satisfaction that they were a touch too large for him and rather worn. He looked wonderfully ordinary. Waters wrung his hands in the background as the Duke admired his nondescript appearance in a full-length glass, and left in a huff when he expressed his intent of wearing his Wellington boots, which were informal and comfortable, and had always grated on his valet's soul. All his linen was of the first quality, but hopefully that would not be as obvious as coats were. He took just a few changes, intending to buy more and plainer items along with toiletries and so on, because everything he had was embroidered or embossed with the Seven Crest. He also appropriated a Patterson's British Itinerary and a copy of The Traveller's Oracle that belonged to Matthew, on the grounds that his need was greater. As he put his luggage together, realizing there was an art to packing and wondering whether Waters was too offended to help, his uncle came in.
You cannot be going ahead with this, Seven.
It is a wager.
This ought to be a clincher to a man of Lord Hugo's generation, but he shook his head.
It is a nonsensical wager. I shall tell Leo to retract.
I beg you will do no such thing. I shall come to no harm, and it will be an interesting experience. And it is my choice. I am above the age of majority, after all.
He said it with a smile, but he'd had to make similar reminders too many times over the last year. If he was of Lord Hugo's or Leo's temperament, he might have said, "How many times must I tell you?" or "Will you remember my place and yours?" He could not imagine saying such a thing to his uncle, and so the comments never stopped. Lord Hugo snorted.
You are your own master, but you are also Seven, and I wish you would consider your position. This is cursed rash behaviour. You will find it extraordinarily uncomfortable hobnobbing with the scaff and raff and sleeping in damp bedsheets. I have no doubt you will catch a chill, and the vile sustenance available at ordinaries will not agree with you. It is very well for the common sort, but I repeat, you are Seven.
It doesn't sound very well for the common sort, the Duke remarked. Should I not know the hardships my fellow men undergo that I may strive to alleviate them?
His uncle eyed him menacingly.
Don't give me that Quakerish claptrap. I see you are determined to be defiant.
You mean to carry out my intention?
That's what I said. Oh, curse it, boy, you have not the knowledge of the world of a child, and I'm not easy in my mind. If anything happened to you, my brother's son, he entrusted you to my care.
Nobody could have fulfilled his request with more attention, the Duke said sincerely.
He would, in fact, have been very happy with rather less attention.
But it is time I learnt to care for myself. I do not wish to be, as Leo said, held up by a scaffolding of service all my life.
Nonsense,
Lord Hugo said.
You're not anything of the kind.
You don't think Leo was right, sir? The Duke said hopefully.
Of course he was right. Naturally, you will not manage for yourself. I meant to say you're quite wrong in your understanding of your position. The service, the attendance, all that. It is not a scaffolding. It is Seven. That is the point. It cannot be Seven and live in a cottage on peas, pudding. Your position must be filled.
My position is filled whether I like it or not.
I should hope you like it, since you are the most fortunate man in England. I dare say it is hard that you had so little time to be Harmsford, Lord Hugo added, sounding slightly less brusque. My brother died too early, and Ermine is a heavyweight on young shoulders. You could have got all this independence out of the way if you had succeeded later on. But here we are, and you have your duty.
I do have my duty, the Duke agreed. And I am truly not going to live in a cottage on peas pudding. But I also have my wager, which I intend to win. So if there is nothing else, sir...
Lord Hugo scowled.
And suppose you fail and people see Leo set you on to this recklessness. I did not coddle you for 20 years in order to have my son blamed when harm comes to you. Good Lord, it was bad enough when that young oaf persuaded you to climb the great oak. You might have been killed when you fell, and the world would have called it his fault.
I landed on him, the Duke pointed out. I have always counted it an act of great loyalty that he broke my fall, especially since I broke his arm. It had no effect, nor had he expected any. Lord Hugo had always taken his responsibility for his orphaned nephew stiflingly seriously. The Duke sighed. Uncle, I proposed the wager, and Leo can hardly be blamed for taking me up on it. I am looking forward to my adventure, and I shall come to no harm. This is a civilized country under the rule of law. Pray do not fret.
I do not fret, Lord Hugo said indignantly. If I'm concerned, it is because I have more regard for your rank and station and safety than you seem to.
The Duke let that pass. I can't write to you here in case anyone should observe the superscription, but I shall think of you, and send at once upon my re-emergence into polite society.
You're a feckless young fool,
Lord Hugo told him, surrendering without grace.
And you will take a goodly sum with you, £100 at least, and the address of your bank, and your card case.
He finally departed, still muttering. And the Duke had about 5 minutes' peace to go over his immediate plans before Leo came in. If you're on a mission from Uncle Hugo, go away, the Duke told him. I shall not withdraw from my wager or let you do so. He did tell me to, Leo admitted cheerfully. I told him I thought this lark would do you the world of good. I shan't inquire as to why you so badly want a month unsupervised, dear Cars, but merely extend my good wishes in your endeavours. The Duke's eyes flew to his face. Leo grinned, a little sheepishly. It occurred to me this morning that you might have taken the opportunity of my foul temper to carve yourself a little freedom, and I don't blame you. In your shoes, I'd have run mad years ago. Just come back safely, or my father will never forgive me. Sev? I apologize for my words last night. I was cursed rude to you mostly because I was in a shocking rage at myself. Matthew dressed me down for jealousy of your circumstances, which I hope isn't true. Although even if it is, the little whelp should still respect his elder. Notwithstanding, I took out my frustration on you and I beg your pardon. Oh, nonsense, Leo. The Duke put out his hand. His cousin grasped it. You're too tolerant and this doesn't affect the bet. I still want your greys. Are you setting up as a whip? Because horses won't do it alone. You'll need to be a deal less cow-handed first. Leo grinned at that accurate hit. I have no aspiration to drive your greys. I wouldn't presume. But Vere covets them, so... Vere? Sir James Vere, you know the man. Yes, I do. And since I do, I have refused to sell him my greys several times. Why would you do such a thing? Because he's the man I lost the money to, Leo said. Did Father not mention that, or were you not listening? He's the very devil at whist, him and that smooth swine he partners with. But I'm quite sure he'd take the greys in settlement, so... You are not giving Vere my horses, the Duke said, not mincing words. The man is a brute. He thrashes his cattle like the worst sort of carter. For God's sake, Leo, you cannot.
I have limited options, Leo said, the humor dropping from his eyes. I lost heavily. More than I can afford, in truth. Villainous, I know. We all make fools of ourselves now and then. Look at my performance, but for heaven's sake, let me give you the money, or lend it if you must be particular,
the Duke added, seeing a familiar mulish expression on his cousin's face. Leo had always made a point of never taking so much as a shilling from his vastly wealthy cousin, supporting his father's position of honest stewardship. As ways of handling the gulf between their positions, it was as good as any and better than many. And the Duke respected that Leo did not expect to be hauled out of the River Tick whenever he fell in. But what was the point of wealth if one could not spend it on people one loved?
I know you'd never ask or expect it, but just this once. Please. I'd far rather spend the money than see my greys in Vere's hands.
I'm not biting your shins. You know how my father feels.
He has never treated my money as his to use, and nor have you. It is mine to spend as I choose.
I choose to spend it on you.
No, I can't ask that. Or take it either. Sev, it's £3,000.
Good God. What were you thinking? I was drinking, not thinking.
Leo waved an airy hand, which did not fool the Duke in the slightest.
It was my foolishness, and I will bear the consequences. But what will you do, other than give Vere my greys, which I must tell you you should not bank on?
I dare say the old man will oblige when he calms down,
or I shall sell out of the funds if I need to.
Your father was generous with his bequests. Leo, that's your income. For goodness sake, don't waste your capital on Vere. Let me loan you the money, and you may repay me at a sensible pace. I'll charge you interest.
I do not and will not depend on you to solve my troubles, Leo said.
Though I shall be delighted if you lose our wager.
Otherwise, dear cuz, I wish you well on your adventure.
His tone made it clear the subject was closed. The Duke negotiated starting his travels in Gloucester. The Bird in Hand Inn, where he'd been robbed, was on the outskirts of the town, and he'd ascertained from the landlord that John Martin had departed in a northerly direction. He'd hoped to pick up the fellow's tracks without too much difficulty. He'd been optimistic. It turned out that ostlers were very busy men who didn't have time to answer the questions of undistinguished greenhorns, whether about who they'd seen or where the coaches were going. In fact, most people were completely uninterested in helping him. One pleasant individual did come up to engage him in conversation, the Duke, having completed a tour on the continent and not being quite such a Johnny Roar as all that, had declined the invitation to take a drink or pass the time with a game of chance. He congratulated himself on that much, and was feeling quite satisfied by his performance once he managed to take a place on the stage to Cheltenham. That was a guess. But it was a spa town where one might find idling gentlemen. It seemed plausible John Martin might attempt to repeat his performance there. The Duke therefore boarded the stagecoach in a spirit of hopefulness that was rapidly knocked out of him. The interior of the coach reeked of the potations of at least two of his fellow passengers, a small boy who'd recently been sick, and another passenger's hot meat pie, which somehow left a film of grease on the Duke's lips from 2 feet away. He was squashed between a rubicund farmer and a buxom lady, both of whom expressed their pleasure that he was such a small man. The coach was unsprung, the seats unpadded, the roads of a vileness, the journey longer than he could have imagined. He staggered out at the other end, cursing John Martin and Leo and himself, and discovered that at some point someone had picked his pocket and stolen £20. At least it wasn't more. He'd split his money up and secreted it about his person and in his luggage. But it had gone from an inner pocket, which was rather frightening, and he had no idea when, which was worse.
and it was a sizable part of his entire worldly wealth for the duration of a month. It was a bad blow on his first day. He'd decided to retire early and ask questions tomorrow, thinking to ensure a good night's rest. That also was denied him, since his person did not command instant obsequious attention or comfortable rooms or the choicest viands. He dined on the ordinary, which was extremely ordinary. A slurry of oversalted, overcooked vegetables and a few pieces of gristly meat. And found himself allocated a dismally dark, smoky space under the eaves, with decidedly damp sheets and rough blankets. Worst of all, the noise from outside was unceasing. Rattling wheels, shouting, an endless hubbub that made him pull the miserable covers over his head and wish himself back in the luxurious quiet of Staplow. Burnt coffee and an inadequate breakfast for a sum he suspected was extortionate did not help his mood in the morning. He was unwashed and had made a poor fist of dressing, and it took a strong effort to command his feelings. If he was uncomfortable, he reminded himself, it was because of John Martin, and he would use his irritation to fuel his enthusiasm for the pursuit. He set himself doggedly to the task. He asked ostler after ostler if they had seen one not particularly notable man out of hundreds, discovering that a shilling was the best coin to win attention, but not too much attention. He made his wearisome way around the edges of Cheltenham, and then ventured into the centre with his senses on alert for acquaintances. It would not be in breach of terms for him to be recognised, but he'd have to refuse any invitations and explain what he was doing in an ill-fitting coat. And word would doubtless get about, and the whole thing would be cursed awkward. It didn't arise because he saw nobody he knew, and in particular, he did not see John Martin. He hadn't expected immediate success, of course, but it was still a disheartening and exhausting day that made him aware he was seeking not just a needle in a haystack, but one with the power of movement. He wanted nothing more than a hot, deep bath to rest his aching feet, and if he were going home to Staplow, Waters would have one waiting ready for him. He put that thought out of his mind, and made his way to probably the eighth and definitely the last inn of the day, the White Hart on the Birmingham Road. It was busy. He would have to wait for a quiet moment to speak to the ostlers. In the meantime, he went inside and attempted to command a room. The landlord cast an unimpressed glance over him.
"I might have a bed. Sit down with a mug of ale and I'll see. Saloon bar's over there."
The Duke didn't want to sit down with a mug of ale. He wanted to be conducted to a comfortable room without delay. He murmured thanks anyway, wondering if he was being polite or merely weak. He went through to the saloon bar. It was occupied by a man who sat opposite a woman wearing a quite remarkable bonnet. He was staring intently at her and had a sheet of paper with a black patch at its center in his hands. She was turned sideways to him, clearly posing. The Duke said,
"I beg your pardon." "Don't mind me," the man said, without looking at him. "Have a seat. Mine hostess will be free to attend you in just a few moments." "I'm having my likeness taken," the lady added, casting the Duke a glance with a smile.
Clearly she was the landlady. She wore an ordinary day dress with what looked like her Sunday best hat. The man was cutting her profile, the Duke realized. He had never seen one done before, only the results. He hesitated, interested but unwilling to intrude.
"You are welcome to observe," the shade cutter said, still without looking.
The Duke moved closer and watched with fascination. The shade cutter had a pair of tiny scissors which he seemed to be holding very still as he snipped, instead moving the paper into the jaws of the blades in a slow but almost continuous turning motion. The scissors cut smooth, confident curves, paring the blackened paper so that the extra material fell away and the landlady's outline emerged, including the hat. It was a surprisingly quick process. The artist cut the remains of the paper surround free and made a few additional snips. He took a rectangular card from a leather satchel, pasted the back of the profile from a little pot, placed it neatly on the card,
and presented it to the landlady with a bow.
Well,
she said, delighted.
Well, good heavens, look at me, see, sir?
The Duke examined it, looking back and forth between paper and woman. It was a striking likeness, considering it was simply an outline without depth or detail. The artist had been kind to her jawline and somehow managed to convey a curve to her mouth that radiated the woman's obvious good humour.
That is quite delightful, the Duke said. You have a remarkable skill, sir.
The cutter glanced up at him with a glowing flash of a smile.
Why, thank you, and thank you, Mrs. Sturridge. Would your good man be having a likeness too? I can see all I want of him any day.
She examined her profile again, beaming.
That's worth a night's lodging to me, and a meal too. And you, sir, she added to the Duke. What may I bring you, ale?
He agreed reluctantly. A glass of wine would be preferable. But he had already learned the unwisdom of ordering any such thing in an inn outside London. He took a seat, while the other man put away his paste bottle and card. The shade cutter was a good-looking fellow with a cheerful sort of face, the kind that looked wrong without a smile. He had a fine pair of brown eyes, and his wavy hair combined bronze, copper, and gold like a handful of coins. No silver there yet. His coat gave the impression he'd worn it for rather too long, and that impression was carried through into the rest of his dress, which was well used to the point of shabby. He looked like a pleasant gentleman, but down on his luck. He also seemed vaguely familiar, especially the bright glinting hair. The Duke had a panicked moment wondering if he was an acquaintance, perhaps someone met in London. But no. Not with that sadly worn coat. And in any case, this was a professional profile cutter, and he'd never sat for a profile, even to an amateur. No, he couldn't place the fellow, but all the same, exasperatingly, he was sure he knew him. The man glanced up, catching the Duke in the act of scrutiny.
Unlike the dancing bear, you may observe me at no charge. Or may I serve you? Would you care to have your profile taken?
Thank you, no. No, I was merely... I beg your pardon, but... Are we acquainted? The Duke said recklessly.
You look very familiar. Do I? I can't say the same, I'm afraid.
That was unsurprising. The Duke knew himself to be entirely forgettable. That was currently a good thing. Just as it was good that the shade cutter wasn't trying to pin down where they might have met. Even if it seemed a rather unfriendly response from a man with a friendly face.
Perhaps I was mistaken, the Duke said. I beg your pardon. My name is...
He bit Seven back, reminding himself that he'd settled on his favourite of his many names, one he never got to use. Cassian.
Good day to you, Mr. Cassian. Charnage.
Charnage, the Duke said. Daisy Charnage. He saw Charnage's smile die, his lips staying curved, but without any happiness behind the expression.
Daisy, if you please, and yes, the same. I dare say you have had a long, tiring day if you are travelling, so I won't disturb you.
He reached into his satchel and took out a book. The landlady returned at that point with two tankards of ale. The Duke took his with a word of thanks, mind racing. Daisy Charnage, the bizarre first name pronounced to rhyme with Hazel, usually shortened to Daisy at school. The Duke had been 2 years behind him at Eton. In fact, he was quite sure Charnage wouldn't remember, since he had been just another small boy and a particularly unimpressive one at that. Titled, yes, but many of their peers were peers. Charnage himself was a connection of the Marquis of Sellingstow, albeit no longer acknowledged as such. There was no reason he would recognize the Duke. There were a number of reasons the Duke should have recognized him and refrained from conversation accordingly. His name had not been mud during most of the Duke's school career. In fact, Daisy Charnage had been a highly popular boy. He'd been expelled, granted, but only for running a gambling ring, which was doubtless very bad, but from a schoolboy's perspective had felt trivial compared to the unpunished cruelty of many of the older boys.
The Duke remembered him as that schoolboy might, a glowing, laughing young trickster, to be hopelessly admired from a safe distance. Not anymore. His father's appalling actions had ruined his son's name and left him penniless and disgraced. Whether entirely by proxy or because he'd been somehow involved, the Duke wasn't sure. He'd been abroad at the time. Then there was the scandal that Charnage had had on his own account a year or so ago. The Duke couldn't recall the details if he'd ever known them. An elopement, he vaguely thought. But Leo had shaken his head. Either way, Charnage had disappeared from good society and now moved in decidedly less elevated circles, attending the sort of parties that the Duke of Severn would never grace with his presence, even if anyone had invited him. And, it seemed, he cut profiles in public houses to pay for his lodgings. That was horribly sordid for a gentleman, or at least a man born a gentleman, and Charnage had doubtless decided to end the conversation before he could be snubbed. He probably received plenty of snubs, and indeed the Duke would probably have snubbed him. Severn could not risk letting an encroaching mushroom grow on the fringes of his ermine robes. He wasn't currently the Duke of Severn. He was the unknown, unrecognized Mr. Cassian, who could talk to anybody he pleased. And he was lonely. And he remembered Daisel Charnage so well as that bright young god at Eton. "So what are you doing?" he asked. Charnage glanced up from his book. "I beg your pardon? At the moment, I mean to say, are you, travelling somewhere?" Charnage didn't make the obvious point that they were in a coaching inn. "Not urgently. Dawdling on my way to an engagement. And yourself?"
"I'm currently struggling with rather a challenging task, which is what brings me here."
Charnage's eyelids drooped.
"A challenging task? Really? Does that involve the placing of horses before a race?"
The Duke didn't understand for a moment, and then he laughed with surprise.
"Not at all, no, and I'm not going to suggest a game of chance or skill either. I'm relieved to hear it."
He didn't inquire further. The Duke was used to people showing rather more interest in his doings. He pressed on.
"The fact is, I was recently robbed."
"Sorry to hear it,"
Charnage said, with no effort to sound sincere.
"Unfortunately, I will not be able to tide you over with a small loan."
This was entirely unfamiliar ground. As one of the richer men in England, the Duke had never had to fend off accusations of breaking shins. Nor had he ever had to work to make people speak to him or feign interest, his family excepted.
"I don't require one," he said. "Actually, I was robbed of a certain item of sentimental value, and I'm trying to discover where the thief went."
"Good God!"
Charnage gave him an examining look.
"Are you a Bow Street runner?"
"Me, no."
"Thief taker?"
"Again, no, I have no experience in this at all."
Charnage's brows tilted.
"I suppose there's a reason you were doing this yourself rather than calling in someone competent."
The Duke's cheeks heated.
"Yes, but the thing is, well, it's rather a delicate matter, for reasons I prefer not to disclose," he added, feeling the weakness of it.
"Naturally, naturally."
Charnage waved that away.
"And you're in this caravanserai to lay hands on the thief?"
"I wish I were. I have been trudging across Cheltenham trying to pick up his trail without success.
I don't know who's anywhere near here, to be honest."
He was blurting out more than Charnage wanted to hear, probably, but it had been a very solitary and disheartening few days.
"The robbery happened in Gloucester, and the only clue is that the fellow took a stage going north rather than south."
"Does your thief have an eye patch, a dramatic scar?"
"Nothing. He looks quite the gentleman, but without any very distinguishing features. A perfectly pleasant, ordinary sort of man."
"You can't just ask at every inn if they've seen an ordinary sort of man recently,"
Charnage said.
"Or rather, you could, but not to any effect."
"I realize that. I do have his name, but it's probably false. John Martin,"
he added in response to a questioning look.
"Oh, certainly false."
Charnage put down his book and pulled his chair round to face the Duke more squarely, as though he'd decided the conversation was worth his interest. The Duke found himself absurdly flattered.
It's a strangely common habit among the false name-giving fraternity to resort to Christian names as an alias for a surname. A man who calls himself Mr. Martin or Mr. Peter or Mr. George is never to be trusted. The Duke would have liked to query such a sweeping statement, and might have done so if he hadn't currently been using a Christian name as an alias for a surname. Thank goodness Cassian was such an obscure name as to be unfamiliar to most Englishmen. That could have been embarrassing. In any case, I can't rely on him using the same name, he said. I need to be honest, I don't know what I need to do. I hoped I would cross his tracks. Charnage made a face. If I were you, did you say this item was of actual value or merely sentimental? Both. Then I'd go back to Gloucester and try the pawn shops. If he stole valuables, his first thought would have been to get them off his hands. I'd say try the fences, but that would require the help of someone familiar with that profession. A discreet thief-taker would be best. I've no idea how to go about that. I dare say I seem rather a greenhorn. A little out of your depth, perhaps. Very much so. I'm not familiar with the area, and I'm not used to travelling from home like this. It was technically true, depending on your interpretation of those words. And in all honesty, I suspect I have bitten off more than I can chew. Poor fellow, Charnage said, with a touch more sympathy than before. Really, are you quite sure you can't put this in the hands of the authorities? Although... Well, an item both sentimental and valuable. Does that make it easily identifiable? Because that isn't an attractive quality to a receiver of stolen goods. A necklace might be more valuable as a collection of matched jewels on a string, but more safely saleable as individual stones. A golden item might be better melted down for the value of its metal, even if that destroys the value of its artistry. The Duke's mouth had fallen open in shock. He closed it. You think? No. They could not melt it down. No, they hope not for your sake. But you might want to get on and retrieve the thing quickly. Yes, I need to. The Duke had the distinct sense of another brilliant idea dawning. He wasn't sure whether he ought to trust that sense, since his previous brilliant idea was not going marvelously. Then again, the clock was ticking and he had not done well by himself, and Charnage, for all his reputation, perhaps because of his reputation, clearly had ideas. I need to, he said again and took the plunge. Would you help me?
Chapter 3 Dazel wasn't sure what was going on. He'd been recognized. But this Cassian fellow hadn't told him where from. That might only mean that he'd been pointed out at some juncture with the usual litany. George Charnage's son, expelled from Eton, the man who failed to elope with Eliza Beaumont. Dubious character. Scarcely more than a Merry Andrew with his cut-out flummery. Bad ton. Then he'd assumed Cassian was attempting to break his shins. In which case the joke was on him, since Dazel had approximately £6 to his name. Still, he'd started paying attention to the slightly odd young gentleman, who wore a coat that had been made for somebody else 2 years ago, but whose very fine linen looked to have been fresh on in the last day or so. He was an unassuming sort, physically, and modest in manner. Yet he'd taken it for granted that Dazel would listen to what he had to say. And he'd been genuinely amused when Dazel had suggested he might be a tout. One could laugh at that sort of thing only if one didn't fear the mud might stick. Cassian. The name didn't ring a bell, but then it was a long time since Dazel had been in good society. He might be a provincial gentleman who kept himself to himself. Either way, he was pleasant, and he didn't seem to be a humbugger. And this was the longest conversation Dazel had had in a while, so he might as well see where it went. Help, he repeated. What sort of help? I need someone who knows how to negotiate this business. Negotiate what, precisely? Because if you mean with fences and thief-takers, I regret that is not my area of expertise. Oh, I didn't mean that, Cassian said hastily. Not at all. I meant,
well, someone who knows about this sort of thing in general, or more than I do. Pawn shops, as you said, and people who give false names and so on. Someone familiar with the more disreputable side of life, not the world of gentlemen.
Exactly, Cassian said.
And then his face changed ludicrously.
Oh, I didn't intend any insult.
That was the